It's Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, stories from the WPR News Department last year ran the gamut from hard political news to science research and human interest stories. We'll talk about what caught your attention in 2018.
First, the partial government shutdown is in its 12th day, and there's still no end in sight.
President Trump and congressional leaders were scheduled to meet at the White House today for what's being described as an informational session on border security, the issue at the center of the budget deadlock.
It comes on the eve of Democrats taking control of the House. Nancy Pelosi, who's expected to be the next House Speaker, says her chamber will pass its own plan to end the shutdown, but Trump has vowed to reject it if it does not contain money for a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border.
And in other news, incoming Republican Senator Mitt Romney is criticizing President Trump in an op-ed, and Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren says she's running for president in 2020. Mordecai Lee is a professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee, a former state lawmaker. Mordecai, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Well, if you tune in the news last, before the holidays, there was a government shutdown over border security. Post-election, there's a government shutdown over border security. Not a lot of movement in the last 12 days or so.
Right. The more things change, the more they stay the same. I suppose probably over the next week or so, we're going to reach some kind of a critical mass where more Americans will be inconvenienced by this. You know, sort of we all take it leisurely during the holidays. But now that we're all back at work, people will start noticing that the IRS, you know, isn't answering, that the national parks are closed, that the Ice Age Trail in Wisconsin is not being staffed. So I think more and more there's going to be this sort of feedback from the grassroots about get this done.
And government employees, federal government employees, some of them not working, some of them working without a paycheck. We're seeing a federal government memo saying, here's how to barter with your landlord if you can't pay the rent this month. Talk about that. We'll maybe put some pressure on lawmakers too, right?
You know, let's take a comparison to the world of business, because sometimes Americans say, well, we want government to operate more like a business. Okay, fair enough. Would a business like, I don't know, General Electric or Johnson Controls, would they fund themselves only until a certain time and then sort of shut down and sort of tell their employees to stay tuned? You know, you can't run a business like this, and you can't run a government like this. You need ongoing operations. And so I really wish that things weren't quite as toxic in Washington, both on the part of the legislative branch and the part of the president. There are such obvious compromises there, you know, just right in front of their noses, but nobody seems to be able to talk to each other.
All right, we have border security, billions of dollars going into that already. The issue, the sticking point, is this thing, a wall. We want, the president wants a literal wall. There's floating definitions of what that might exactly look like. Why is this one issue such a sticking point in past efforts to pass a spending bill and now with the shutdown?
Well, For President Trump, then he was the candidate for President Trump, building a wall was a kind of a signature issue. It was sort of, I'm really going to stand up against, sort of fill in the blanks, stand up against illegal immigrants, stand up against criminals who are coming over, stand up for America. Whatever it was that he was conveying, it was the symbolism of the wall that just really captured the attention of the Republican base, who voted for him in primaries over more traditional conservatives like Jeb Bush, let's say, or even Scott Walker. So it's come to a point that he's painted himself into a corner. I think, Rob, you sort of hinted where the compromise could come, that the outgoing chief of staff said, well, it doesn't have to be a physical barrier from coast to coast, from the Gulf of Mexico to San Diego. We realize that in some places it doesn't have to be a physical barrier. That, it seems to me, is where the compromise is. And right now there are some physical barriers that have been funded by Congress, Democrats and Republicans alike. So I really don't quite understand this.
Talking to Mordecai Lee from UW-Milwaukee about some of the top stories in national politics. The big one this week, the federal government partial shutdown and efforts to end that. Never ask you to predict the future, Mordecai, but do you see this thing going on a long time? It seems like both sides, President Trump wants $5 billion for the wall. Democrats want to give zero, at least in this particular spending package, for the wall. So where do we go?
Okay, Bill, I'll make a prediction, but Rob, you'll have to promise me to erase this tape if I'm wrong.
I can't promise that, but go for it.
Okay, I'm going to suggest that it's going to be over by next Monday or Tuesday.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. How do we get there?
I think it's going to be this sort of soft definition of what the funding is for, and then both sides will save face, and finally we'll get government back operating again.
And one thing that's been brought up in the past, and now Republican Senator Lindsey Graham bringing back this idea, he says, okay, Democrats fund the wall. In exchange, we'll finally do this DACA protection. People brought in the nation illegally when they were children, saying, okay, they won't be deported. We're going to lock that into law. Do you see that being part of a compromise?
That would be a wonderful compromise. In other words, everybody gets half a loaf, or everybody gets one thing and they give up one thing. You know, that's what happens on playgrounds and kindergartens. And we need some adults in Washington who understand what it is to negotiate and what it is to compromise.
All right, but for many of in the base, for President Trump, some Democrats as well, compromise isn't on the agenda. It isn't something they'll support. It's viewed as a betrayal these days in a lot of ways.
You know, Rob, I really like that observation. You really hit the nail on the head that in the old days, you know, we used to say that half a loaf was better than none. Nowadays, it's such odd math and algebra, sort of, no loaf is better than half a loaf. I mean, I don't understand. This is logic turned upside down. So sooner or later, I think we're going to reach a crisis point where both in Madison and in Washington, people are going to say, okay, we've had all our sound bites, we've had all our yelling at each other, now let's just get this done. Let's compromise.
Democrats are saying we don't want to come to a meeting with President Trump and be lectured or have lots of false claims. The president tweeted a tweet that had the number of illegal immigrants in the country at about three times what most estimates have it at, saying that Mexico is already paying for this via this NAFTA replacement that isn't in effect yet. How do you see that playing out?
Well, I think the key is whether the meeting that they have is going to be with cameras or without cameras. You know, when there are cameras in the room, and this was even my experience when I was in the state legislature, people act differently. They act to the cameras. And there's a lot of sort of melodrama and sort of fake confrontation. If you keep the cameras out of the meeting, then they can sort of let their hair down and they can talk frankly and they can say, let's figure this out. And they won't be scoring points on whether it's Fox News or MSNBC.
You know, it's kind of weird because you think, okay, more cameras, more transparency. We don't like smoke-filled rooms and closed-door negotiations. It sounds like you're saying closed-door negotiations work better.
I know, Rob. It does sound odd to be saying that because we as Americans believe in transparency. We believe in open government. But as Americans, we also understand that when people can speak confidentially, they can say things that they otherwise would not want to say on the record. And that's how things get done in closed meetings. And so I do think that that's part of government and that we as Americans should accept that as how things work.
We're talking about the latest in national politics with Mordecai Lee from UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker.
You can join the conversation. What's your reaction to the government shutdown? Is President Trump right to hold out for money for the border wall, or do you agree with Democrats who don't want to add to the border security budget to build a wall? What do you want your side to do? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. UW-Milwaukee Urban Planning Professor Mordecai Lee stays with us. We're talking about some of the big national political stories in the news. The big one, and we want your reaction. How are you feeling about the federal government partial shutdown? What do you think should happen, if anything, when it comes to a compromise over border wall funding? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas at WPR.org. As always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. To your calls now. Ruth is with us in Altoona. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I think your representation of the standoff between the Democrats and President Trump is not a fair one, because when you say that he campaigned on this issue and people supported it, that was because he said he would have Mexico pay for it, that the American public would not pay a single penny for this wall. And so that was his promise, not to build a wall, but to build a wall and have another country pay for it. So that is not what he's able to deliver.
Thanks for the call, Ruth. Mordecai, Democrats have been bringing that point up recently.
You know, fair enough. That's it. Ruth is accurately saying what he said in his speeches. But ever since Mexico said that it would not pay for it in his rallies as president, he's still talking about building the wall. He simply no longer talks about Mexico paying for it, and he still gets, you know, a huge ovation for doing it. So I think it's still red meat politically and still effective as a promise, even though he's not talking about Mexico paying for it, but now that he's president.
Thanks for that call, Ruth. And he has mentioned a couple times that Mexico will, in fact, pay for the wall via the new, as I mentioned, in the new NAFTA deal. That doesn't exist yet. It has to be ratified by legislatures, and there's no provision to create a funding stream from that deal to a wall, right?
You know, the president, I hate to have to say this, but the president is an exaggerator, and the president is not hemmed in by what we would traditionally call facts. And so he says things and asserts things without necessarily having factual documentation. And I think that we as Americans, we're not used to that. And we somehow have to get used to this new norm that a president does not hesitate to exaggerate about things that aren't factually accurate, and that this is just sort of the new ballgame of political rhetoric.
Let's take another call on the shutdown and border security funding. Bob is with us in Wanakee. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
What do you think?
I'm not so sure that the Democrats are going to allow Trump to be able to tout the fact that they caved in to him on the wall issue, because he will conveniently forget to mention DACA or any other compromise that they allowed and continually push the fact that he won on the wall issue. Just my thought.
Bob, thanks for the call. Mordecai, both sides looking to declare victory on whatever comes out of this.
Right. One option, following what Bob was saying, is that you could put the DACA program, creating it as a statutory program instead of as an executive order program, you could put that in the same bill that might have the funding for the wall, or the authorization for funding for the wall. So no matter what the president would say, it would still be the same signature. Now, you know, another compromise following what Bob is saying is if the president is insisting on $5 billion plus, maybe they'd compromise on $2.5 billion. Again, there's room for compromise, and no matter what the president might claim, the Democrats would be able to make their case as well.
Thanks a lot for that call, Bob. We're talking to Mordecai Lee from UW-Milwaukee about some of the top stories in national politics. Want to move on to some of the other stuff going on right now, Mordecai. We have this incoming senator from Utah, a fellow named Mitt Romney, former presidential candidate. He writes an op-ed. It's in the Washington Post. He supports President Trump on a lot of policy items, tax cuts, judge appointments, that kind of thing. But very critical of President Trump and his leadership style. How significant do you think this is?
I think it's significant in the sense that there are now two Republican parties. There's the party of President Trump and his allies in Congress who vociferously support him, as does Fox News. And then there's this sort of vestigial old Republican party of the Bushes and of the Romneys. Senator Jeff Flake, who's just stepping down because he couldn't get reelected because he was criticizing President Trump, who are saying that our Republicans need a different tone and Republicans need to communicate differently and they need to convey more efforts at unity and compromise. So I think it'll be interesting to see how Romney's career goes. In other words, is this a viable splinter group of the Republican Party? Up to now, it hasn't been, and Romney was elected to a six-year term, so he's got time to try to survive this, but I'm not really sure that there's much of that wing left in the Republican Party.
Well, Mitt Romney, as you say, he just got a six-year term, so at the most, that would be he'd be running for re-election in a year when Donald Trump would end his second term, if he has one. So he's not necessarily risk, and he's running in Utah. It's hard to imagine Mitt Romney losing a race in Utah. I don't know. He's in a pretty safe space to make comments like this.
I think so. And it's sort of the opposite of what happened to Jeff Flake in, let's see, was that Arizona? That all of a sudden the bottom dropped out, and he was going to get primaried by somebody who was a Trump supporter. And Flake, reading the polls, realized that he would get defeated in a primary and would not be able to get reelected. And so he just announced he was not going to run for another term. I think you're right, Rob, that the politics of Utah with Romney would be slightly different from that.
Is it, some people have said, okay, we've had some prominent Republicans criticize President Trump, but not necessarily take action where it counts, voting against the president's priorities, that sort of thing. What are you going to be watching for with a senator like Mitt Romney and the Senate majority?
Romney did a very interesting thing in his column where he said, I'm not going to feel obligated to respond to every single tweet and every single comment that President Trump makes that I disagree with or that's an exaggeration. But he said, but I will consistently call for changing the tone of the presidency and changing how he communicates. And so you're right, Rob, that Romney said he agreed with the tax cut. He agreed with the Supreme Court nominations. So it's not on policy, on the substance of public policy, that he's disagreeing with the president. It's how the president is so different from the norm that we expect coming out of the White House and presidents.
Let's turn to the race for president in 2020, because we're all really excited about this already, Mordecai, I know. We're watching probably a lot of Democrats are going to be in. The latest is Massachusetts U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, widely expected that she'd get into this. She's going to be campaigning in Iowa already this weekend, of course, a state that goes to the not primary, but caucuses pretty early. Talk about Elizabeth Warren as far as policy and ideology and where she fits into the Democratic spectrum.
Well, for those of your listeners who are just sighing because it was only 2 months ago that we had the midterm elections, there's a political logic to declaring early in 2019 that you're going to run for president in 2020. And that's exactly what you said, Rob, the Iowa caucuses. And the Iowa caucuses are approximately 1 year out. And so the November election in 2020 is a long ways out, but it's only a year to that first caucus. And so if one is a candidate and you want to create a grassroots campaign, you want to recruit volunteers, you want to recruit coordinators, you want to make appearances and get commitments, 12 months is not that far out. And that's the logic of what she did. And I expect, Rob, that by the end of the month, we're going to have two or three or four more declared candidates. And I guess we're going to end up with a baker's dozen of declared candidates by the time we get around to the Iowa caucuses. And I think the more the merrier. In other words, it's sort of like 31 flavors. Let the voters decide who exactly they like more. And it could be that in a fractured caucus that a person wins a caucus with only, I don't know, let's say 30% of the vote because everybody else got less than that. But nonetheless, there will be a winnowing out, and eventually it'll narrow down to a kind of a one-on-one knockdown fight.
And where do you see Elizabeth Warren as far as strengths and weaknesses, given her one big platform she's had is consumer protections on financial for financial industries? I don't know if there's a big constituency out there that loves the big banks, so that might be good for her. How does she stand out from the expected field?
I'm not sure she stands out all that much. She's very articulate. She's very appealing to some voters. She has such an interesting background. She was involved in these financial issues around the time that even before the bank started collapsing in 07 and 08. But nonetheless, I would put her in the sort of more liberal wing of the party. She's certainly not a Clintonite. In other words, she's not triangulating for the middle. So she'll be out there competing probably less with a Bernie Sanders kind of candidate, but with more moderate liberals, some of the other Democrats, maybe Cory Booker, maybe Kamala Harris, I think they're all going to be really bunched up together as moderate liberals.
And so, Mordecai, who's going to win this thing? No, I'm just kidding. I won't ask you to do that. It's way too soon. It's too soon.
Oh, bless you.
I want to bring things home, Mordecai, in the last few minutes to here in Wisconsin. We've got Tony Evers, governor-elect, being sworn in coming up on Monday. We're hearing from outgoing Governor Scott Walker saying he's going to stay in Wisconsin, be part of a speaker's bureau, going to work with some groups and advocate and speak on conservative political messages, advocate for President Trump's reelection, among other things. Talk about the role of the ex-governor in Wisconsin. Jim Doyle and Scott McCallum, usually pretty quiet, except toward the end of last year, criticizing the changes in this lame duck session. Tommy Thompson had a post-governor career, of course, in the cabinet, running for U.S. Senate. What do you see Governor Walker doing as ex-Governor Walker now?
I think Governor Walker is probably going to be a little bit like the former sheriff of Milwaukee County, Mr. Clark. that he's a national figure and he does traveling, he gives speeches, he gets interviewed on Fox News, and that's a livelihood, that's a profession, that's an activity. So I think it's pretty clear about that. In terms of his involvement in Madison area politics in the state capitol, towards the end of his second term, I think we were hearing voices from the state assembly Republican caucus and the state senate Republican caucus that sometimes they disagreed with Governor Walker, but sort of for the sake of party unity and solidarity, they would support him. I think we're going to be seeing them sort of declaring independence and being much more autonomous, and that his ability to influence the outcomes within the state legislature, I think, are going to be quite limited. Now, I've got to put in a plug, because I'm a professor, that we all know that Scott Walker never finished his college degree, his baccalaureate degree. I'm going to kibitz from the sidelines that I urge him to go back to school, get a degree, you know, maybe get a business administration degree, that I think he would find it very, very helpful for his future career.
And let's turn toward the future now. We'll have Governor-elect Tony Evers, a Democrat, with this still Republican-controlled legislature. In our last minute or so, Mordecai, do you see room for getting stuff done?
Well, you know, at the top of the news, he threatened that he would veto a Republican budget that the Republicans sooner or later are going to have to compromise. They're going to have to negotiate with him. And so, in a sense, we're repeating the conversation that we just had about Democrats and President Trump about the funding for the wall. Sooner or later, for government to function, you've got to have a compromise. And I think some Republicans will say, oh, heck, it's okay not to have a budget. We'll just work on a continuation of last year's budget. But sooner or later, everybody will want something, and then they'll finally compromise.
We'll leave it there for now. Mordecai, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Mordecai Lee, professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. We talked with him about the federal government partial shutdown, Elizabeth Warren running for president, other political stories at the state and national levels.
Coming up after the news, we'll look back at the most read stories from WPR in the last year, a list that includes healthcare, politics, and plastics and beer. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up, what's the best way to make money? Doing something you love. And it seems that many YouTubers have figured out how to do just that. We'll talk about what makes a YouTuber popular and why so many young people are big fans.
First, we've heard a lot lately about the biggest news stories of 2018, but here at WPR, we were curious about what kinds of stories resonated the most with you over the last year.
So our digital team compiled a list of the top 10 most read stories on WPR.org. It turned out to be a list with a lot of variety, including everything from political news to research about microplastics in Wisconsin beer.
Andrea Anderson is a digital news director, a digital news editor for WPR. Andrea, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, now looking at this list of stories, before we get into the particulars, it's interesting the amount of variety that got people to click through and check out these stories.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that I was not surprised about when I was creating this was that there was a lot of variety. There was environment, healthcare, politics, and that's just stuff that our readers and listeners are always interested in. It was not shocking to me that there was such a variety, and I think that's really great. Our audience is really intelligent, and they're interested in lots of things.
And, you know, I might guess, oh, what was the top story of 2018? And my answers do show up on the list. And then some things that I wouldn't have thought of that are, you know, important stories, but a little quirkier, and we'll get into a couple of those, also made it onto the list. So sometimes those unique things really get people's attention.
Yeah, absolutely. Like microplastics in beer, you know, that was a big thing. Essential oils being used in an ambulance service was our top story. And that was really, it shocked a lot of people, but also it's a topic people are really interested in, which is healthcare and opioids. So that was shocking, but not surprising at the same time.
Yeah, let's touch on a couple of those you just mentioned. And I could say I missed this one on the way through. essential oils being used instead of opioids in hospitals. So just briefly, what was going on in that story?
Yeah, so this is about Tri-State Ambulance, which is an ambulance service in the La Crosse area. And they're using essential oils to help treat pain, nausea, and anxiety instead of using opioids when it's appropriate. So the medical director of Tri-State Ambulance told Hope Kerwin, who reported on this story, that using aromatherapy is a way to cut down on the use of pain medication, such as opioids. And that was really interesting to a lot of people because they're like, essential oils? I talked to a lot of people about that being number one. And they go, essential oils, really? They can be used in an ambulance? And I thought that was super interesting and really, like, it touches on a topic that people are really interested in, which is opioids, criminal justice system, and healthcare.
Right. And at first glance, that's kind of a, huh, what? But digging into that story, there are some cases, it turns out, where people were being given opioid medications in an ambulance who didn't need them in the first place.
Right.
And that's huge. That's a huge part of this opioid story.
Yeah. So what happens is they actually put a few drops of an essential oil on a cotton ball, and then they'll tape the cotton ball onto the patient's chest in the ambulance. And the medical director told Hope that, you know, this is also, it helps with the treatment, but also the environment of an ambulance, which can be really terrifying and sterile.
Right. Yeah. Now, and then the microplastics in beer, I mean, contaminants in beer, that's going to be a big story in Wisconsin. That doesn't surprise me so much.
Right. I mean, it's environment, which Wisconsinites are really passionate about, and beer, which Wisconsinites are also really passionate about. So I think when you combine those two, you're really going to have like a story that lots of people in the state care about. And what was interesting about that was that U of M researchers found microplastics in 12 brands of beer made with water from the Great Lakes. And so I think when this idea was first pitched as a story, people thought microplastics in beer. And then the more people learned about it, the more interested they became in it. And I think that showed with our audience was that it was shocking, but really interesting. And another thing that is that it's not just limited to beer. It was found in sea salt and tap water.
Interesting. And that's among the clicks you got on this story was from us here at Central Time, because we ended up doing a segment on that. And that's, we've been following that whole microplastics and Great Lakes water story. Honestly, it was one of our earlier segments when we started the show like 5.5 years ago. So it'll be interesting to watch trends over the years, won't it, to see how these stories keep popping up.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it pops up in cosmetics too, microplastics being used in cosmetics. And the researcher who talked to the reporter for this story said, you know, hopefully what people can take away from this is that we use a lot of plastic in products when we don't need to. So hopefully that this study can be used down the line to guide what we are and aren't using plastic for.
We're talking to Andrea Anderson, digital news editor here at Wisconsin Public Radio, looking at the top 10 most viewed stories at WPR.org. What that tells us about us and about you and what you want to hear about. Now, Andrea, I think if you asked me what was the biggest story in Wisconsin in 2018, I'd probably go with something like the election, a big change at the top of state government. And at least, and I know we wrote a lot of stories about that here at WPR, one of those made it to the top 10 list.
Yeah, so we had quite a variety of stories in the top 10 list, but one of the biggest stories that didn't make the list, which I think was surprising for lots of people that I talked to across WPR, was when the state legislature passed a few measures through the lame duck session this year. I mean, that was something that all of us at WPR were following really closely. And, you know, we had reporters who were working through the night into next morning. We had lawmakers working hours after hours after hours overnight, and it wasn't even among the top 10. That story wasn't among the top 10, but what was among the top 10 was the state budget committee working to pass these measures before it went to the state legislature. So that was really important to people. We had Governor-elect Tony Evers defeating Republican Governor Scott Walker. That was among our top 10. We had a poll that was the first poll that came out after the August primary for the gubernatorial race. And that was among our top 10, and that poll showed Tony Evers leading Scott Walker. And what I thought was really interesting looking back at that story was you had both campaigns, Walker's campaign and Evers' campaign, saying this is going to be a tough race, and like this is an important race that people are really watching. So looking back at that story, I thought it was like a little bit of foreshadowing, but not, because how can you foreshadow at that point?
Sure. And one thing that strikes me about those kind of stories is we write probably, I don't know, 50 or 100 stories in a month, maybe, on a governor's race, something like that. So if you put all of those together, that might be cumulatively the top story. But for one particular instance to break out against, say, the essential oil story, where there's only one piece on that. So that might be why the top 10 list shapes out the way it does.
Yeah, that's incredibly possible. I would really like to know like what goes on in people's brains to kind of figure out what really is the most interesting to them, because I wonder if at some point they get a little inundated with politics and need a little bit of a breather, or, you know, some of that hard-hitting news. So when you see like essential oils and ambulances, it's like just a little bit of a break.
Now, of course, we cover the whole state here at Wisconsin Public Radio. One of the stories that made the top 10 list came from Danielle Kading in Superior, reporting on the dramatic flooding. Not the only floods in Wisconsin this year, but very dramatic flooding in northern Wisconsin back in June. It seems so long ago already. That's a story that, I mean, dramatic pictures, dramatic things going on, that caught people's eye.
Yeah, absolutely. I really think those visuals help bring people to where a story is. And Danny does a really great job of covering a large swath of the state and getting news out there quickly for our listeners and readers. And this story was it was a big one for her area. And so this was a story about another round of heavy rains. And as you said, it was in June. It caused two deaths, a number of road closures and washouts that were long term, and the rainfall caused high waters in some areas that rivaled the flooding that occurred in June 2012. And if people can remember back that far, that was 6 years ago, and it caused tens of millions of dollars in damages.
We'll be talking more about dramatic weather events in Wisconsin in 2018 tomorrow afternoon with a Wisconsin-based meteorologist. Andrea, I know 2018 is done. There's no way to predict what's going to be next in 2019, but what kind of stories are you watching for that you think are watching for on behalf of listeners, I guess, to catch those stories that maybe are off the beaten path that they're going to click on?
I really think that any story that is human interest, that brings a real person into the story, that can share something that they've experienced and something that's touching them, whether it's politics or the environment, something that a person can convey and tell their own story about, is really going to interest our audience. So I don't think it really matters what topic it is, but so long as there's another human being who's experiencing it that can share their story with our audience, I think our audience is really going to latch on to that and feel that.
I'll watch out for those. Andrea, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
Andrea Anderson is a digital news editor for WPR. She was with us to talk about some of the most read stories from WPR.org in 2018.
Coming up, a 7-year-old reviewing toys is number one on the list of highest paid YouTube stars. We talk about YouTube culture and what makes someone a YouTube star, coming up right here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up, a renewable energy advocacy group says that 2018 was a big year for renewables in Wisconsin. We'll talk to the director of the group about the growth in alternative energy and what's ahead for 2019.
First, for those who aren't regular viewers, trying to understand YouTube culture and what makes people click the subscribe button can be a little confusing. The highest paid YouTube stars of 2018 included a 7-year-old coming in at number one and a bunch of video gamers playing games and talking about those games.
Hey Ryan, what are we going to play with today?
We're going to play with Hot Wheels Ultimate Garage! It even comes with 5 cars and 1 helicopter.
Boom! And you are watching this video right now, then that means you love surprises. Everyone, pause
what you're doing, and I need you guys to pay attention.
Are you ready?
Now, this shade is a very icy white, but it does have a beautiful green undertone. So you guys know you can take these with your fingers, you can take them with a brush. I like to just go like this, and literally, ready for this? Just pat them on, literally. Just pat them on, baby. You ready for it?
Someone's going to crack me.
Oh, hold on.
It's them. Ah! Oh, it's so scary. I had 4 kills as well.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you or is someone close to you a big YouTube viewer? Do you subscribe to some of these top-ranking stars? What do you like about watching their channels? Are you trying to become a YouTube star your own self? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
Jitendra Sadeb is a celebrity news and pop culture expert. He's researched the power of YouTube stars and appeared on shows like CNN Tonight and Access Hollywood. He's also a regular contributor to publications like The Guardian and Forbes and is the author of the new book entitled The Kim Kardashian Principle. Jitendra, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Darrell, for having me. It's lovely to be speaking to Wisconsin and yourself.
Well, thank you so much and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year.
For listeners who might not be big YouTube users, how would you describe the culture of YouTube?
You know, it's such a phenomenal culture. In 2014, I gave a research study and an interview to Variety magazine. And in that interview, I said that YouTubers were more influential than traditional celebrities amongst younger generations. And at that stage, you know, in 2014, people were like, PewDiePie, KSI, Smosh, I mean, we haven't even heard of them. And who could possibly be more influential than Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston in Hollywood? But now we're actually seeing that come true. You know, we're seeing a lot of these YouTubers break through now and more money than traditional celebrities and be more influential.
While people use YouTube for all kinds of things, from how-to videos to watching shows or even music videos, it does seem like young people seem to be the more dedicated users. Are you seeing it that way as well?
Absolutely, yeah. I think that YouTube is definitely a younger generation platform. Millennials, Generation Z in particular, the youngest generation we have at the moment, the youngest cohort, they are truly digitally native audiences. They don't know a world without YouTube. They don't know a world without cell phones. So absolutely, it is first and foremost a younger audience. Having said that, younger audiences now are teaching their parents, you know, about YouTube and older generations. So we're being led by more technology savvy younger kids now. So in that regard, yes, it is for younger kids, but at the same time, the older generations are also joining in.
Yeah, looking at this list of the highest paid YouTube content producers and what you know about the YouTube culture, what do you think makes someone more likely to make it in YouTube or make themselves famous by using YouTube exclusively?
Yeah. Well, the appeal of YouTube stars and YouTube celebrities versus traditional celebrities in particular is that they are authentic. They are real. So they are taking their true passions, whether that's video gaming, reviewing toys, as we saw that 7-year-old Ryan doing it, $20+ million last year. Do beauty tutorials like Jeffree Star. I think we heard him at the start of this segment. They're taking their passions and they are truly turning them into businesses. And that's really appealing for younger audiences. You know, today, younger generations want to march to their own drumbeat. They want to, you know, they don't want to work to live. They want to live to work. And when they see these new types of celebrities doing exactly that, that can be really inspiring and influential.
A lot of the money that they're making has a lot more behind it than just their videos. Many are selling gear and items. They're even getting sponsorships. Can you talk a little bit more about being an influencer and how you would go about doing that?
Yeah. Well, firstly, I mean, you know, influencers very much are about, coming up with a passion that you truly believe in. And developing your own following. And once you develop that following, once people start noticing who you are and they start telling their friends about you, then your following can grow pretty quickly. And that's the power, really, of the relationship between an influencer versus a traditional celebrity. Fans believe they have an equity stake with influencers because we found them when they weren't famous and they made them famous. So that's a good place to be. And then the way that you'll make money as an influencer is through brand endorsements, either, you know, reviewing products and, or putting your brands up, names of the brands in your videos, or even, you know, doing branded content, creating special videos for particular types of brands. So there are lots of ways in which you can actually then start making money as a result.
Jitendra Sadev is a celebrity news and pop culture expert. He is also the author of the book, The Kim Kardashian Principle, and we're talking about the power of YouTube and what it means to be a YouTube star and a YouTube influencer. You were talking about, just briefly, about the fan bases of some of these stars, and I wanted to just expand on that a little bit. People subscribe to their channels to receive updates, but what keeps people coming back to watch videos by the same people or the same person?
Well, I think it's because of their characteristics. You know, they're real, they're authentic, they're candid, they're funny, they have no filter. All the things that younger generations have now been raised around. So you see with the internet, with social media, you see a lot of the younger generations are really savvy now. They can tell if a traditional celebrity is saying that they like a product because they're trying to flog it. They can tell whether somebody is fake, right? So this whole idea of authenticity detectors, younger generations have strong authenticity detectors. And why they love YouTubers so much is because they're real, they're authentic. And that can be really powerful today to really connect with somebody on a device like your computer, which is a very intimate device, and see skits, see sort of people really just being who they are and being proud of who they are.
Now, you talked about some of the YouTube stars, and for some of them, it's a meteoric rise to stardom. But there is a downside. There's been some rocky times for a few of these YouTube stars, like Logan Paul and PewDiePie. It seems that they've been only slightly damaged. But what are some of the long-term effects and the downside to being a YouTube star?
You know, there are always risks whichever way you turn. And I think that when you are authentic, when you have no filter, when you really put yourself out on the line, you're always going to be open to criticism, to a lot of hate. And I think the good thing about YouTubers is that they know how to turn that to their advantage because they've been used to that. Wherever their social media, wherever anybody is given a platform, there is always going to be somebody who's going to criticize them. So that's just part and parcel of it. I mean, PewDiePie is still very much in the game. Logan Paul is still very much in the game. And they learn from, you know, they learn from the responses they get from their fans, and they decide themselves whether they want to take those risks again or whether they want to change their strategy.
Is there a danger of YouTube burnout?
You know, like any celebrity, like any product, you have a life cycle. So, you know, one YouTuber is not going to remain popular forever and a day. And the difference between a relationship between a traditional celebrity and a YouTuber, it is more intense. So a fan is more likely to jump to another YouTuber if that first YouTuber isn't putting up enough videos, because they want more and more nowadays. The more content you can give, the more happier fans are and the more intense their relationship is with YouTubers. So absolutely, there is a risk of burnout, but the YouTubers that can create, continue to create content and continue to satisfy their fans' appetites are going to continue to be successful.
And finally, do you think the lifespan, in talking about stardom and the risk of burnout, do you think the lifespan of a YouTube star is likely to be shorter than other celebrities?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, YouTube celebrities are still a new phenomenon. So we have to wait and see just, you know, how long one particular star will keep, you know, burning bright, so to speak. We've obviously had a lot more case studies with traditional celebrities. But you even see in a traditional celebrity format, although you might be still seeing, you know, big icons in Hollywood, they're not necessarily, those celebrities aren't necessarily drawing in the bucks at the box office anymore. So, you know, there's a difference between whether somebody is still famous and whether somebody is still making money. So time will tell, but certainly they seem to be rising and rising at the moment.
Jitendra, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks so much for having me.
Jitendra Sadev is a celebrity news and pop culture expert. He's researched the power of YouTube stars and appears on shows like CNN Tonight and Access Hollywood. He's also the author of the book, The Kim Kardashian Principle. He joined us to talk about the YouTube culture and some of its biggest stars.
And if you or someone in your family is a big YouTube fan, you can tell us about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. Who are some of your favorite YouTubers? What keeps you coming back to them? Or what's turned you away from them? Email ideas@WPR.org. New Year's Day is behind us now. Now it's time to put our resolutions into action, if we made any. Darrell, do you do New Year's resolutions these days?
I don't. I haven't in a few years, and partially because I never followed it. But one New Year's resolution I did do a few years ago, and that was I decided I was going to stop playing the pools for March Madness because I was in like 10 or 12 of them, and it got to a point where I wasn't enjoying the games anymore. So I stopped, and I've
cold turkey.
Cold turkey.
Never turn back.
Never turn back, and I love watching the games ever since.
That sounds great. I don't do a thing called resolutions anymore, but I have certain like kind of goals in my mind for a new year, and I've actually already hit one of them. I was like, this year I'm going to learn to use the new office phone system and be able to leave voicemail messages and check my voicemail messages. January 2nd, boom, it's done. I am a successful new phone system user.
That's
I won't
I
say
heard.
How many months it took me.
That's what I heard you doing earlier.
I know I often just say my name repeatedly. Yeah. Rob Ferret. Rob Ferret. But this time there was a reason. I was recording my outgoing messages. All right, resolution or, you know, guideline met for 2019. If you're doing a resolution, tell us about it. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. More to come here on the Ideas Network.